I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Our conversation today is with an anthropologist who rides the garbage trucks in New York City and says Americans want their garbage and their garbage men and women invisible. But first, Zimbabwe President Robert Mugabe's ruling party has announced there will be a runoff election. Mugabe claims last Saturday's presidential election ended in a stalemate, but the government has refused to release the exact poll numbers. And opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai has said he won the election outright. Earlier today, hundreds of war veterans took to the streets of Zimbabwe's capital, Harare, in support of President Mugabe. Yesterday, armed riot police arrested several foreign journalists, and an opposition party says its offices were raided. For more, we go to Andrew Meldrum. He's a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. He reported in Zimbabwe for more than 20 years for both The Guardian and The Economist. Andrew, why would Mugabe agree to this runoff?
Oh, because he will not publicly admit that he lost the election. I think it's important to note that he said, you know, I did not lose this and my party did not lose control of the parliament, and we're going to contest that in the courts, and we're going to fight a runoff election. So he's not admitting defeat in any way.
There was some hope that through negotiations, especially with South Africa, he could negotiate a soft landing, but it doesn't look like he's going that direction.
No, it doesn't. He's a fighter, and he will continue fighting. And his party is encouraging him to do that because they're very well aware that both the generals and the police and the party cabinet ministers, they know that they will be held accountable for the corruption and for the crimes, the human rights abuses that have occurred under Mugabe's rule. Mugabe may get a soft landing and may be given amnesty, but they would not. And so I think they're encouraging him to continue.
Let's remind ourselves, we mentioned the guerrilla fighters who took to the streets today. They were the fighters who helped Mugabe overthrow the government in 1980. Later, the Zimbabwean government was formerly Rhodesia, and military leaders in particular seized white-owned farms. Some of these military leaders received the farms, so there's a lot at stake.
There's a lot at stake, and also, as I say, not only the farms, but also whether or not they will be held accountable for the crimes that have been committed, particularly at the final years of Mugabe's rule.
Well, we know you're in touch with people in Zimbabwe. How is it there today, as much as you can ascertain?
There's a real new sense of worry. There had been a euphoria and an optimism amongst Zimbabweans that really they were seeing the last days of Robert Mugabe. But most people were concerned. They know that he's a fighter, and now they see him coming out, and they're battening down the hatches. Because they know that it's going to be a very tough time. And Mugabe still controls the army and the police, who have inflicted a great deal of suffering, particularly on the people of Harare. And they are battening down the hatches for that.
Well, armed riot police, as we said, entered a Harare hotel and took away five foreign correspondents yesterday. That included New York Times' Barry Barak. When you worked in Zimbabwe, you were also arrested by the government for abuse of journalistic privilege. So what are your thoughts about those journalists that have been arrested or detained?
Barry Barak is being held in the same jail where I was held, and I can tell you it's a pretty rotten, stinking, filthy place. However, he is being represented by a Zimbabwean lawyer, Beatrice Mtetwa, who is a very brave and committed human rights lawyer. She's a brilliant lawyer, and he's in the best possible hands with Beatrice Mtetwa representing him.
Well, and just very briefly, what do you think happens now? Because the opposition party says Mugabe has, in effect, declared war.
Yes, I really think that it will be a continued the war that Mugabe has fought in Zimbabwe for the past 8 years against the population of the country, and he's continuing that. He's going to battle. But his options are still limited. What I think is that he will have in the runoff elections, he will not have the reform that ensured that the results were posted outside each polling place. That made him boxed him into a corner where people knew what the vote was. And I believe he's going to take that away and say, no, we're going to revert to our old Zimbabwean standards for elections, which are opaque and which I can declare myself winner and no one will know.
Well, the world will be watching. Andrew Meldrum, a reporter in Zimbabwe for more than 20 years now, a Nieman Fellow at Harvard University. Andrew, thank you so much for helping us out today.
Thanks, Robin.
Every year, Americans generate about 230 million tons of solid waste, enough to cover the whole state of Texas 2.5 times over. While some of us take our own trash to the town facility, the town dump, most have it picked up. And New York University anthropologist Robin Nagel has been writing on New York's garbage trucks to study trash as a way of studying us. Forget about getting the walls to talk. According to Nagel, our garbage cans have the real story, but we don't want to hear it. We want our garbage out of sight and mind. Robin's been talking to garbage men and women, yes, around 10% of New York City sanitation workers are women, about what garbage reveals to them. In 2006, the New York City Department of Sanitation named her its anthropologist in residence, and we welcome Robin today for a conversation about garbage. Welcome.
Thank you.
Start by telling me something that will surprise me about New York City garbage.
To me, the most surprising thing about New York City garbage is the quality of what is thrown away. And my favorite example is a day that I was loading out a truck, filling a truck. It was pouring rain. It was after a snow. And one of the men I worked with had sort of a sense about this one plastic bag, and he split it open, and inside were silk and cashmere and merino wool sweaters and very high-end label pants, and they were all absolutely perfectly my size. So I took them home, I dry cleaned them, and I wear them often.
To this day.
Oh, of course. They're very good quality clothes without a smudge on them anywhere. And I especially like to wear them when I'm talking to people from the sanitation, because it's usually my concluding story about the riches of the job. They like to see, you know, that I'm wearing what they call Mongo, which is treasures that people throw out that someone else decides to keep.
This is a piece of lingo that you picked up as you worked as a sanitation worker, part of your fascination with garbage. Were you really in the uniform on the truck?
Oh, yes. I was in the uniform on the truck. I had to take the civil service exam and the physical exam and get my truck driver's license. And, yeah, my favorite place to be in New York is on the running board on the back of the garbage truck. You're sort of surfing the streets.
Well, from that vantage point, what else did you learn about being a sanitation worker?
A couple of things that really struck me. One is that when you wear a sanitation worker's uniform, it's one of the most effective cloaking devices you could ever hope for. If I ever wanted to rob a bank, I could just go in dressed as a sanitation worker, and no one would remember what I looked like.
We sort of treat them the way we treat our garbage. It's sort of invisible.
Exactly. It is invisible. And it's invisible to the point where I was working a parade once. I had to sweep debris from the grass to the street so that the mechanical broom could come and clean it up. And I stood in front of people in my uniform with my broom, not 3 feet from them, saying, "Excuse me," you know, politely but firmly. And I finally gave up because they didn't see me, they didn't hear me, they didn't acknowledge me.
So what do you make of all of this? I mean, you know, we kind of know that as a culture, we consume things, and then, as we said, we just look the other way and hope that somebody else takes care of getting rid of them. And we really do. You know, I try to be really nice to my garbage men. but it's something.
Just thank them for their work.
Well, we don't thank them the way we thank firemen or policemen. What is it all about?
Sanitation workers take away stuff that reveals to us, sort of betrays to us, the impermanence of life. And as humans, that's frightening. Things don't last. And by implication, we don't last. So when they come and take away all of our rejected stuff, the goods gone bad, we have to ignore it. Or if we started to pay attention to how ephemeral the material world around us can be, we would then maybe begin to look at how impermanent we are as beings in the world, and how really the kind of the ravages of time and change across history, they're going to eat us all up eventually. And that's really, especially in this culture, you know, American, contemporary American culture, that's a very frightening idea. So I think it's related in some very big, not conscious level to a fear of death, a fear of impermanence, a fear of aging, a fear of change, a fear that we will not continue in this sort of vital, life-filled way that we assume we can always continue it.
Well, there's the ecological aspect of it as well. You take students and people out to the Fresh Kills, huge, huge Fresh Kills garbage dump where all this...
Wait, let me correct you real
quick.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
It's not a dump, and I want to be clear about that because it started as one, but over time, with various laws and innovations in waste technology, it became a landfill. A dump is something unguarded and unprotected and almost out of control, whereas a landfill is an engineered, carefully designed solid waste solution. And it isn't really a solution because, of course, all that garbage doesn't go anywhere. It just sits there festering for decades. But yes, Fresh Kills is a fascinating place.
Well, and I stand corrected, and there is a language, as we've been saying, of garbage, and Fresh Kills is a landfill, and in fact, someone is describing it in an article I'm reading as a giant Napoleon, which is a pastry. It's hard to wrap your brain around, but because it's layers of garbage and then dirt, how do they treat the garbage there?
When it was an active landfill, each day's work was covered with earth and compacted, and then the next day they would move to a different quadrant to have that be the open face so that as the garbage was dumped, it was also a form of engineering the shape of the hills themselves so that there was always earth over the day's work and then eventually a geothermal membrane that is quarter-inch thick, sort of a plastic rubbery thing. It's part of the capping process. And then you have several more feet of earth on top of that and then various species of vegetation, some of which get there on its own and some of which is planned and planted. It will be the largest park in the city once it's transformed into that, although the transformation will take a few decades. It's a beautiful, beautiful place, even today, even as it's still sort of kind of austere and a little moon-like on some of the more recently closed faces. But there's something fecund and rich and just the size of it. You can't stand anywhere on Fresh Kills and see the whole thing. It's true that you can see it from space with the naked eye. That and the Great Wall of China are the only two human-made structures visible to the naked eye in space.
And you say in an article we're reading, people will visit the Fresh Kills landfill the way tourists go to the cemeteries in France. It will stand as a great monument like the Great Wall of China. Why?
Well, think about how in the last 50 years, particularly at the lower levels, the stuff hasn't decomposed because there's no oxygen. Nothing can live down there to eat the decomposable materials. So in a way, it's this accidental, inside-out, uncatalogued museum that stands for us now, who we are and what we've done and how we've structured our lives. So we've created these repositories, these time capsules, and if they were, when they are excavated, they will speak for us much more clearly than written records or computer databases ever could, because there's the stuff of us. I get a little emotional about this, because if we love our civilization, what better way to honor it than to change how we understand its discard? Now, archaeology as a discipline has been founded on reading trash. It might be 5,000-year-old trash, but those are the remains of ancient cultures, and we've now left this archaeological treasure trove that someday will speak for us.
That's anthropologist Robin Nagel talking about garbage and garbage men. They have private clubs, she tells us, where they talk about the pride of their job despite the childhood trauma of being told a failure will be to grow up to be a garbage man. We're going to have more. And later, what might that meeting between President Bush and Putin be like, given that they're currently in war of words? Back in a minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with more from New York University anthropologist Robin Nagel. She studies New York City's garbage. And just before the break, we were talking about how the trash in our landfills, those 8-track tapes and fast food containers, is a treasure trove for future archaeologists, in part because at the bottom, even the food can't decompose. So, Robin, why is it so important for someone 100 years from now to discover, say, a Nathan's hot dog?
Imagine analyzing the chemical composition of the hot dog and then wondering how the hell we survived eating that stuff, right?
Maybe we didn't.
Maybe we didn't. That's right. But as a marker of, well, you could take any single object and look for other examples of it over time, like hot dogs. Eventually they'll come through with tofu dogs and, you know, nitrate-free organic hot dogs. And you can create a certain portrait of a people just by that one variable.
Well, and you write that in 100 years from now, garbage won't be garbage anymore. Sanitation workers won't throw it away. They'll take it to vast reuse centers, much more than we do now. And they'll finally be the heroes that you think they should be now, because we'll see how sanitation workers keep the city alive. Let's talk more about the sanitation workers that you've met. In fact, you know, they've told you they may be invisible to us, but we are not to them. Give us an anecdote of what a sanitation man might tell you he sees about someone through their garbage.
Well, men who work and women who work the same route for a long time will be able to give you a pretty savvy sort of sociological or anthropological read of a given block or a given neighborhood based on how they read the discards of a given house or a household or a block, so that they can tell you things like, well, these two people met and they married and they had two children, a boy and a girl, and the children are more or less these ages now, but now they've separated, and actually now the divorce is final. Oh, and actually he's now seeing men, and she's suing for sole custody, and oh, the cancer has been cured, but now there's psoriasis.
Why? Because they see medications, or previous to that maybe they saw, what did they see?
Photographs, letters, emails that are printed and thrown away, medical, yes, prescription bottles of prescriptions that are done, children's toys, children's diapers. My favorite example was, and it's sort of a mini example of this little narrative that I just gave, was a photograph of a woman and a man, a black and white, very pretty picture at some seashore somewhere, and the man's face had been hacked out of the picture with some small blunt object and was lying on top of the garbage can. And the sanitation worker I was with looked at that and chuckled and said, oh, guess they broke up. I didn't think that one was going to last very long.
Huh.
And he didn't know the name of the woman in the house from having met her. But we have this strange blindness to how easy it is to read us. And, of course, sanitation workers will read. They'll do that kind of analysis of when you see, you know, simple things like more empty beer or wine bottles, and the brand that's being thrown out will indicate something about the economic fortunes of the people doing the drinking. But the quantity will also tell you something. Is it that they had a party, or that they happen to know the guy is now on a bender and he can't stay off the Coors Light, you know? And what does that mean about, oh, well, you know, he lost his job?
Do they really look at that? Do they really? I mean,
they don't stand around and study it, but it passes under their gaze as they're working. The bags that we use are not impenetrable, and they break very often, and what's inside spills out, and then you read it as you go.
I want to ask you more about just garbage in general. We're more and more aware of being a consumer society and wasting so much and throwing out so much. But you're right that because we just don't want to look at this, just even the way it gets picked up in New York City is complicated.
Yes. It's a kind of patched-together system that's come into being over many years, and it's not unique to New York. It's how it happens in many, many cities in the United States. You can have as many as three trucks on one block on one day. For collection, that's garbage. For paper, recycling. And then it's for plastics, metal, and glass recycling. So that's three separate trucks, and they go to three separate places. We then, now in New York, we have nowhere to put our own trash in our own borders, so we have to take it to other places, usually out of state, which costs a lot of money because the people who take it from us charge us for leaving it there. We also have to drive it there for the most part.
Could Manhattan put its garbage anywhere in Manhattan?
Well, sure. I mean, you could do anything you wanted if you had the political ability to do it. But there's the NIMBY syndrome, not in my backyard. And that's actually now becoming the banana syndrome. Build absolutely nothing anywhere near anybody. And then pretty soon we're getting to nope, which is not on planet Earth. Now, that's fine if you don't generate garbage. But if you generate garbage, it has to go somewhere. And throughout time, we've come up with basically a few answers to this. You put it in the water, you bury it, you burn it, or you turn it into something else, like compost it and repurpose it. That's sort of throughout history. That's about all we've come up with. The other option was, in smaller scale societies, to just pick up and move when the town got too dirty. Not easy to do that with, say, Naples or New York City.
You know, it's hard to imagine a New York prior to a sanitation system.
Sanitation didn't exist in any effective way until the 1890s. And I've seen photographs taken in the early 1890s and then in 1895, sort of the before and after. And it was unimaginably disgusting. There was horse muck and rotting food and the carcasses of animals, and the muck was ankle high and shin high and in some places knee deep. We were world famous for being really, really dirty. So once the problem was dealt with directly, this incidence of disease like yellow fever, diphtheria, scarlet fever, whooping cough, pneumonia, those diseases, the incidence went way down. Infant mortality rates went way down. And over time, health analysts began to see that life expectancy rates went up. So if you want to save children's lives in ghettos or in very poor corners of urban spaces, clean them. Clean those streets. That will do more than an army of pediatricians in helping children live to adulthood.
That's New York University anthropologist Robin Nagel, honorary anthropologist in residence at New York City's Sanitation Department. She's working to start a museum of sanitation to show how life as we know it now is made possible by sanitation and sanitation workers. Robin, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Okay, Monday on Here and Now, Biracial America. A black mom wants to believe her biracial kids will have the better future Barack Obama speaks of, but she worries, will they move easily between two worlds or not fit in any? That's on Monday. Still ahead, the peace symbol is a baby boomer. That's after the news, Here and Now. President Bush is headed to Croatia today after wrapping up business at the NATO summit in Bucharest. Bush and Russian President Vladimir Putin participated in a group meeting today, and the two outgoing leaders will meet face-to-face this weekend at Putin's vacation home. It might be somewhat tense. Yesterday, Bush won NATO approval for a U.S. missile defense system in Eastern Europe, something Russia vehemently opposed in its own backyard. And while Bush didn't get an immediate commitment from NATO to admit the former Soviet republics, Ukraine and Georgia, he did get a pledge to consider the country's membership at some point, and Putin is assuredly unhappy about that. So how's that meeting this weekend going to go, and what happens after that? Marshall Goldman is here. He's senior scholar in the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard. His upcoming book is Petrol, State, Putin, Power, and the New Russia. So, Marshall, if you were a fly on the wall at this meeting, and you've been in some of these rooms, what would you expect?
I expect, actually, the two of them are going to get along reasonably well, at least privately. At the end, they may issue statements saying, well, this is American policy that's not the same thing as Russian policy, and so there may be some tension there. But if you've watched their body language, and if you've heard each one on the other, you have to be impressed by the fact that they've bonded in ways that are, if you'd asked me to predict this kind of bonding, I would say no.
Well, especially since some analysts are saying this may be the beginning of a new Cold War. A Russian official said, a culture of searching for solutions on the basis of taking mutual interests into account has been lost.
That's true, but your question was, what's it going to be like in that room?
The two men, right?
And so, I mean, here's the paradox. In the room, the two of them are probably going to be very buddy-buddy with one another. I mean, and their wives in the same way. But in terms of what comes out of the room, in terms of policy and what remains afterwards, that's more difficult to predict, and it's probably not going to be as cozy.
Do you think this is the beginning of a new Cold War?
There are certainly signs there. Now, again, we've come to a juncture, an important juncture, and that is that there's going to be a new president in Russia who so far has issued some statements which suggest that maybe things won't be so tense. And, of course, we don't know who the new president will be here. So it could be that both countries end up with leaders that are determined to make accommodations, much like Bush and Putin did at the beginning of their terms.
Touch on that further, because it's thought that Dmitry Medvedev, the successor in Russia, was sort of placed there by Putin, and Putin isn't really going away.
Putin's not going away, but Medvedev, the guy who comes in, had been Putin's disciple for almost a decade, and was brought in not from the KGB. I mean, most of us thought that the person who would succeed Putin would be somebody from the KGB, somebody, a man by the name of Ivanov, who was much tougher on the United States. So it's what makes this so interesting. It's not certain what's going to happen.
Well, let's take these two squabbles one at a time. The fight over the missile defense system that Bush solidly won with NATO proving it. Couldn't Bush backers say, look, Russia sells Iran oil and nuclear technology. Russia acts in its own self-interest, even though we don't want them to. Is there a certain sort of winking, tacit acknowledge that each is going to do something or that angers the other?
So far, there seems to be. Of course, Bush, by saying we're going to insert a radar in the Czech Republic and missiles in Poland, comes right to the front door, and it's as provocative a step as I think you could possibly take to the Russians.
And the Bush administration insists it's to defend against Iran.
And defend against Iran, but the Russians then say, and Putin himself has said this, well, you promised us you would not expand NATO to our borders, and you have. So if we can't trust you on that, how can we trust you about these missiles? You say you're going to install a few missiles. There may be up many more by the time we're through. I can at least understand from where Putin is coming. And I think we have to be sensitive to that. At the same time, you don't want to give them a veto of who can belong to NATO.
Let's go to that. That's the discussion of Ukraine and Georgia. Why is Ukraine in particular so important to the Russians? Why are they so angry about this?
Ukraine and Belarus were two other Slavic republics. So there's Russia, the three of them, Ukraine and Belarus. There is also this kind of feeling that the Russians are big brothers to the Ukrainians. For that reason, the Ukrainians hate it. There's very strong anti-Russian feeling among Ukrainians. I've discovered that over the years. They don't want to say nice things about the Russians, but the Russians feel, you know, they're ours, and we should be friends with each other, and they should belong to us. And if they go to NATO, then that means they're automatically our enemy.
Well, and, you know, there's the back history. I was reading just yesterday, the lower parliament voted that the mass starvation of Ukrainians in the 1932-33 famine, which many historians believe was engineered by Stalin against the Ukrainians to get them to give up their land and to destroy the upper class and fuel the growing industry of Russia. Well, yesterday, the lower parliament ruled that wasn't genocide. Now, even Alexander Solzhenitsyn, the dissident, came out and said it was not genocide. So they made a pointed statement towards Ukraine yesterday. What's that?
You touch this and you're going to get complaints from no matter what you say.
All right, let's have at it.
But the Russians say, look, this was not anti-Ukrainian, but the Ukrainians say, look, millions of us were killed. How many millions, we don't know. And we were the breadbasket of Europe. Stalin came in and broke up our land, seized the agricultural products, and left us so that we starved. It was a brutal time. And so it's the Ukrainians see this was a conspiracy. Again, going back to that fierce nationalism that exists and the anti-Russian feeling that's so strong in Ukraine.
Well, I was going to say, it's part of today. Well, I can't help but notice the title of your book, Petrol State, Putin Power and the New Russia. How much does that have to do with the jockeying that we saw at NATO?
Well, I try to argue in the book that it has a lot. For example, Germany gets 40% of its natural gas, which is very important, from Russia. Overall, all of Europe gets over 25%, closer to 30% of its natural gas. And we've seen instances in the past where the Russians have just simply turned off the valve, so that particularly in the winter. Think of it as a hornet's nest. What do we want to stir up that hornet's nest for and have them issue this gas? So gas becomes really a factor in determining the politics of the region. And I think that's the answer.
So these NATO members are not likely to want to anger Russia by making a vote in favor of allowing Ukraine to be a member.
I think that's fair
Georgia.
To say they don't want to do it needlessly. And you know, on big issues, I suspect that they'll still stand up on, you know, what do we want to mess around with little small things?
Well, what does any of it matter in that both men are leaving office? Is there sort of a certain stalemate that people are going to have to live with for a while?
One of the fascinating things is that at the end of his administration, Putin invited Bush to come over and let's kind of see if we can't set things out in a healthier framework so that our successors will indeed be able to get along. So that can't we clear away some of the antagonism? Now, partly they've built antagonism into the process, but I think it's wonderful that the two of them have agreed to meet. It's maybe partly on the government's expense. This is the last time Putin can invite Bush in at the Russian government expense, and maybe it's the last time Bush can go on government airplanes. But I think it's possible. They will try to work it out. And the very fact that they're even trying, I think, is a hopeful sign.
So that headline that's emerging, a possible new Cold War, can maybe be reversed in time.
Well, I think it's 50-50. I hope, but at least it's 50, whereas before it really looked like we're heading for a collision, and that's not so good.
Marshall Goldman, senior scholar at the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies at Harvard. Again, his upcoming book, Petrol State, Putin Power and the New Russia. Marshall, thank you as always.
Thank you, Robin.
And a quick reminder, next week, General David Petraeus and Ambassador Ryan Crocker go before Congress to testify on the prospects of U.S. military presence in Iraq. We're going to, of course, cover that for you. You're listening to Here and Now. The peace symbol turns 50 today. I bet there's no one who can't picture that circle with the three lines in it. But who created it? Well, the peace symbol was created by a pacifist in post-war England for one of the first big anti-nuclear protest marches. It became an international icon, the flashpoint in Supreme Court battles, even a fashion statement. Ken Colesbun is a photographer, historian, and peace activist who's co-written the book Peace, the Biography of a Symbol for the National Geographic Society. He joins us from his home in California. Ken, peace.
Peace. Everyone wants peace.
Everyone does, and it's amazing that people don't know more about the history. You've spent most of your adult life, I understand, photographing peace symbols, collecting peace buttons, pictures of people holding the peace symbol. Why?
Well, first of all, it's a very colorful and captivating history, and I was fascinated by this simple little icon right at the beginning during the Vietnam period in the late 60s. And thousands of people had it. They displayed it in many different ways. Artists, you know, it was all over the place.
Well, and it was only about, at that point, 20 years old. Let's go back to the beginning. A textile designer in England named Gerald Holtham actually created the symbol. How did he come up with a circle with a line down the middle and two others kind of drooping on each side? Because we understand it was used in nuclear disarmament marches in England. At first, he was thinking of a Christian cross. And then he decided to incorporate semaphores. This is a system of spelling words using flag positions. What were his semaphores?
Well, it was the semaphore N for nuclear and the semaphore D for disarmament. The vertical line is the disarmament, and the drooping arms are for the N, the nuclear. So we had nuclear disarmament.
Huh.
And he put this in the circle representing the unborn child, eternity.
Mm-hmm. And then we understand the first appearance in the U.S. was a photograph of those protests.
Right, in Life magazine, 10 days later. And then it was picked up by various groups and, of course, used quite a bit during the Vietnam War.
Yep, in the late 60s, even U.S. soldiers in Southeast Asia were wearing it even when they were ordered not to.
Right, and I even have a peace symbol that a Marine had made, converted from Carter pins from a grenade. They formed it into a peace symbol.
The peace symbol has been the focus of a number of free speech court cases, some of which, you know, went all the way to the Supreme Court.
Right.
Activists wanted to put peace symbols on the flag, or in one case where peace symbol armbands in school. And by the way, the courts usually come down on the side of free speech and display of a peace symbol.
Right. That famous case, the Harold Spence case in 1970, a young fella, he hung the American flag outside of his apartment window and taped a peace symbol over it. Ultimately, it went up to the Supreme Court, and Justice Blackmun, one of my favorite judges, he wrote an opinion in favor of Harold Spence. He says, a person gets from a symbol the meaning he puts into it, and what is one man's comfort and inspiration is another man's jest and scorn.
And that brings us back to Gerald Holtham, who created it. Do you think people really understand that it came out of the nuclear disarmament movement?
You know, I've done my own personal surveys over the last few years, and I find pretty much people under 50, you know, they pretty much feel that it stands for peace. But very few know the original meaning, you know, that it stood for nuclear disarmament.
Hmm.
And what's so interesting about the symbol, of course, is that it took on many meanings. Anti-nuke, and then it moved to civil rights over in this country, and then anti-war, the Vietnam War, and then, of course, moved into the environmental movement.
Yeah.
And the next question is, what will it stand for next?
What do you think?
Well, I think perhaps that the way things are going in this country, maybe we need something where there's more clarity in government and maybe Wall Street. So to have this book, it's going to put the peace symbol in really good, positive territory.
That's Ken Colesbun. He's a photographer, historian, and peace activist who's co-written a new book for the National Geographic Society called Peace, the Biography of a Symbol. Ken, thanks for speaking to us about it.
Thank you very much, Robin.
And by the way, next week we'll have the B-52s, the group named after their beehive hairdos. They're back. We'll hear their new music and, of course, Love Shack. That's next week, Here and Now. 40 years ago today, Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated in Memphis, Tennessee, and America's inner cities began burning. In Boston, a few stores were looted, one was set on fire, but the word the next day was that it was about to get much worse. Singer James Brown was scheduled to perform at the Boston Garden that night. Then-Mayor Kevin White wanted to cancel the show.
His concert, we thought, might bring as many as 15 or 20,000 black people from the community, particularly young people, into the city. It just had too much emotion not to decide whether that would be a problem.
Now I feel so good I want to scream. I feel so good I want to scream, people. Is it all right if I scream?
But some Boston city leaders lobbied Mayor White, insisting the concert would help calm the city. White relented, and James Brown took the stage.
Now wait a minute. A few years ago, I used to sing a song that sounds something like this. I loved it tomorrow. I don't love it today.
A new documentary that airs tomorrow night on the cable channel VH1, titled The Night James Brown Saved Boston, recounts how the show, broadcast live on public television, helped keep peace in Boston. Here now is Bob Oakes spoke with two people who remember that night well. Jimmy Early Bird was a local DJ and booking agent for James Brown, and Kenneth Guscott was the president of Boston's NAACP at the time. He'd just returned to Boston.
Well, when I got back, the first thing at the airport, I tried to get a cab to take me to my home in Grove Hall. And the cab driver, who was a black guy, said, "I'm sorry, but I can't take you up there. It's too dangerous." So we agreed that he would take me over to the NAACP headquarters. One of the things that people were concerned about back in those days was people tearing up the city. So we had details set up that gonna tell people, don't be tearing up our city. So it was a confrontation. The people who wanted activity and the people who lived in the city that didn't want them to be tearing up our city.
Jimmy Bird, was it dangerous?
Yes, it was very, very dangerous. I was there in Grove Hall trying to talk to the young brothers to be calm and cool. And I told them, well, listen, here's what we're going to do now. We're going to go see James Brown. I promised to let them meet James Brown. So I had a little group up there of guys in Grove Hall. So they agreed to that. So I asked them, please, don't tear up the stores, don't tear up the clothing stores, don't tear up the restaurants, because this is all that we really have. And it was hot, man.
Jimmy, let me ask you this question.
Yes.
How important was it for the black community that the James Brown show go on?
It was very, very important. At that time, James Brown had more influence on black people than any other entertainer in the world.
Kenneth, do you think that's why Mayor White eventually listened and let the show go on?
Yes, I do. He had no other recourse.
At that time, Mayor White did not know who James Brown was. He told me, is that the football player? He was talking about Jim Brown of the Cleveland Browns.
Let's listen to a soundbite of then-Mayor Kevin White on the stage inside the Boston Garden saying a few words before the James Brown show.
All of us are here tonight to listen to a great talent, James Brown. But we're also here to pay tribute to one of the greatest Americans, Dr. Martin Luther King.
Jimmy, you were in that room inside the Boston Garden. Describe the mood at the show.
I was really afraid. But I knew that if anybody could calm the brothers there, it would be James himself.
But there were still some tense moments between police and the concertgoers.
Well, yes, what happened was there, some of the young brothers, these are the young kids, wanted to get on stage and dance with James Brown, you know, and interrupt the show.
we actually have another clip of James Brown speaking from the stage, challenging the crowd to stay calm as members of the audience were climbing up on the stage to dance with James Brown. Here's that clip.
You make me look very bad, because I asked the police to step back, and you wouldn't go down. No, that's wrong. No. No. That's wrong.
Jimmy, was James Brown successful in keeping the garden calm?
You better believe it. 1,000 times over. It just really amazed me. He calmed him down, went back into his dance, and the show went on.
Kenneth, Boston did not suffer the same fate as other U.S. cities touched by rioting following Dr. King's assassination. Was it because, in your opinion, of James Brown's performance at the Garden and the broadcast of that performance on TV?
Absolutely. In addition, the people who were in charge of the city, that's the mayor, the governor, the police department, they were frightened. We worked very closely with the police headquarters. We were out there, I remember, for over 3 days trying to calm the people down. And that's the thing that a lot of people don't realize, that the black community did not want their community tore up.
So in addition to the concert itself, and in addition to the TV broadcast of the concert, it was really the black community, the black leaders in the black community, who kept neighborhoods relatively calm.
There you go. You hit the nail on the head.
That was responsible people in the community saying, you're not going to tear up our city.
What's your most enduring memory of that night? Kenneth, let me start with you.
Dealing with the police department, they were as nervous as I was. And when the concert was on, they were watching it.
And Jimmy, what's your most enduring memory of that night?
I think that was it, too, how the black community with Brother Ken calmed the fellows. And we left the Boston Garden that night peacefully. There were no riots. There were no, you know, robbing anybody or anything like that. And I remember so very vividly how the young guys, someone went home to watch the show because it televised it 2, 3, 4 times in a row. In the meantime, the people from the community were meeting with City Hall and things, and everybody got their head together, man. It was just a beautiful thing to see and to be a part of that history, I'm telling you.
Here now is Bob Oakes speaking with Kenneth Guskett, who in 1968 was president of Boston's NAACP. He also spoke with Jimmy Earlybird, who was a local DJ and booking agent for James Brown. The new VH1 documentary, The Night James Brown Saved Boston, airs tomorrow night. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org. Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.